Welcome to the deep dive. You're here because, well, you want to really understand things, right? To get to grips with a topic, but without getting totally overwhelmed by all the details.
That's the idea.
And that's what we're doing today. We're diving headfirst into this period that often feels like a silent chapter, you know, between the Old and New Testaments.
Mm.
But it turns out it's absolutely buzzing with stuff that shaped the world Jesus and his followers actually lived in.
Absolutely critical stuff. We're talking about the intertestamental period, yeah. Sometimes called the Second Temple Judaism era. It's roughly those 4 centuries, give or take, from about 450 BCE up to 70 CE.
400 years.
Right. And while the Bible doesn't, you know, lay it all out chronologically for us, understanding these years, it's like getting the crucial backstory, suddenly the New Testament clicks into place much better.
Okay, think about it like this. Imagine Ezra and Nehemiah. Guys we know from the end of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if they suddenly pop up 400 years later in Jerusalem or Galilee.
Right.
What would they even recognize? And what new things would just completely blow their minds? You know, how people lived, how they worshipped. It's a huge amount of time. So much change.
It really is a massive transformation. And to get a handle on it, we have to look beyond the biblical books themselves. We've got things like the Apocrypha, these Jewish writings, valuable historically, even if not in the Hebrew Bible.
Oh.
Then there's the Pseudepigrapha, other ancient Jewish writings, often attributed to, you know, big biblical names. We also have the historians like Josephus and the philosopher Philo, both writing in the first century CE, super important.
Josephus, right. Heard of him.
Yeah, and the Targumim, too, these Aramaic translations or paraphrases of the Hebrew Bible used in synagogues. They show how scripture was being understood back then.
Aramaic, not Hebrew.
Well, Aramaic was becoming the common language. And then there's rabbinic literature. Now, that was written down later, but its roots, the oral traditions, go way back into this period.
So quite a few different puzzle pieces to work with.
Exactly. So our mission, our deep dive today, is to pull out the really key bits from all this. Focus on the history, the religion, the context that shaped the world Jesus stepped into.
Okay, let's do it. Where do we start with the history? It's a long time.
Well, we can break it down. Think of it in, say, 4 main chunks, 4 eras, each left its own mark. First up, the Persian period. That's roughly 539 down to 331 BCE.
Okay, Persian.
And it kicks off with a really big event. Cyrus the Great of Persia, he conquers Babylon in 539 BCE. And the crucial thing, he lets the Jewish exiles go back to Jerusalem, lets them rebuild the temple.
Ah, Cyrus. Yeah, that's huge. That rebuilding was finished around 516 BCE, wasn't it?
That's right. And think about how different that was from, say, the Assyrians or the Babylonians before them.
Oh, yeah. They just scattered people, right, to break them up.
Divide and conquer. The Persians offered a way back home. This act by Cyrus, it really marks the start of the Second Temple period. And it's interesting, the Old Testament narrative kind of wraps up with Malachi around 450 BCE, smack bang in the middle of this Persian rule.
So the Old Testament story ends, but Jewish history obviously keeps going under the Persians. What else is happening then?
Well, some really significant things start taking shape. First, the Jewish diaspora. The scattering of Jewish communities outside Judea really begins to grow. These communities would become incredibly important later.
For spreading ideas, yeah.
For spreading ideas, for trade, for interaction with other cultures. And we also see the beginnings of synagogues.
Ah, synagogues. So they start this early?
The foundations are laid here. They weren't just for worship initially. They became these vital community centers, places to learn the traditions, especially for Jews living away from Jerusalem and the temple. This model, it really influenced early Christian gatherings later on.
That makes sense. Community hubs, what else?
The oral law starts developing more formally. These are the interpretations, the applications of the Torah. The first 5 books passed down verbally for generations. It becomes a really central part of Jewish life.
So interpreting the written law for everyday life.
Exactly. And language-wise, Aramaic starts to take over as the everyday spoken language. Hebrew remains the language of scripture, of prayer, but Aramaic is what people are speaking day to day.
Like Jesus would have spoken.
Most likely, yes. Aramaic. And don't forget the context. The Persian Empire was enormous, stretched from Egypt all the way over to India. So Judea is just one part of this vast empire.
Okay, so Persia sets the stage, allows the return, synagogues start, oral law develops, Aramaic spreads.
Yep.
Got it. What's the next big shift?
The next chapter is the Greek period. Runs from about 331 to 164 BCE. And the big name here is Alexander the Great.
Alexander.
Right.
Rolls through, conquers pretty much everything.
Pretty much. He defeats the Persians decisively. Battle of Issus in 333 BCE is key, and he takes control of Israel by 331 BCE.
And Alexander wasn't just about military might, was he? He brought Greek culture with him.
Oh, absolutely. That's Hellenism. The spread of Greek language, Greek philosophy, customs, city planning, art. It was a cultural tidal wave. It was so influential that even the Romans, centuries later, basically adopted huge chunks of Greek culture, including their gods, just with different names.
Right. Jupiter for Zeus and so on.
Exactly. Now, Alexander dies young, 323 BCE. His huge empire gets split up among his generals. For Israel, the key players are the Ptolemies, based down in Egypt.
Okay.
They rule the area from about 320 down to 198 BCE. Then the Seleucids, based up in Syria, they take over in 198 BCE.
So two different Greek dynasties ruling Israel one after the other. Did they rule differently?
Yeah, they did. Under the Ptolemies, things were, well, relatively peaceful for the Jews. This period sees a really important Jewish community flourish in Alexandria, Egypt. Becomes a major center of learning.
Alexandria. Wasn't that where the Septuagint came from?
Exactly. The Septuagint, the LXX, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, a massive achievement from this time. It made the Hebrew scriptures available to the whole Greek-speaking world, hugely important for the New Testament writers who quoted it all the time.
Wow, okay, so the Septuagint is a product of this Ptolemaic Greek period. Things sound relatively okay then, but then the Seleucids take over.
Yes, and that's when things get much rougher. It really comes to a head under Antiochus Epiphanes IV. He rules from 175 to 164 BCE.
Antiochus Epiphanes? Sounds ominous.
He was bad news for the Jews. He ramps up taxes, aggressively pushes Hellenization, trying to force Greek culture and religion on everyone. But it gets worse. He plunders the temple in Jerusalem, not once, but multiple times, kills thousands of Jews who resist.
Just terrible.
And then, the ultimate insult, he sets up a statue of Zeus in the temple and sacrifices a pig on the altar.
A pig in the temple. Mm-hmm. Beyond provocative.
It was the ultimate desecration. He outlawed Jewish practices, Sabbath, circumcision, reading the Torah. The temple essentially became a pagan shrine.
You can see why that would spark a reaction.
Absolutely. It ignites the Maccabean revolt, led by a priestly family, Mattathias and his sons. His son, Judah, Judas Maccabeus the Hammer, becomes the main leader.
The Maccabees, right. Hanukkah relates to this, doesn't it?
Exactly. Against all odds, they fight back, drive out the Seleucids, win back a degree of independence, and critically, in 164 BCE, they cleanse and rededicate the temple. That event is what Hanukkah commemorates. John's Gospel even mentions Jesus being in Jerusalem during the Feast of Dedication, which is Hanukkah.
Wow. So a period of intense persecution, this incredible uprising, reclaiming religious freedom, that must have left a huge psychological mark.
Undeniably. So takeaways from the Greek period, the spread of Greek language and culture, which is unavoidable, the creation of the Septuagint, super important, and this intense clash with Hellenistic religion setting the stage for so much religious tension later.
Okay, so after the Maccabees win, that leads us into the next phase.
Right, the Hasmonean period. Named after the Maccabean family line, this runs from about 164 down to 63 BCE.
Hasmonean, got it. So Jewish rule again.
Initially, yes. After Antiochus Epiphanes dies, his successors are a bit more reasonable. The Hasmoneans keep fighting, and by 142 BCE, they've basically kicked the Seleucids out completely and even expanded their territory.
Sounds like a golden age, maybe. Self-rule after all that foreign domination.
It started with that promise, but, well, it got complicated. The Hasmonean rulers who followed the original heroes, especially from the second generation on, they became increasingly dictatorial, corrupt, yeah. Even adopted some of the Hellenistic ways they'd fought against.
Oh, the irony. Power corrupts, I guess.
Seems like it. This led to a lot of internal conflict, different factions fighting for power within Judea. It got so bad that eventually some Jewish leaders actually appealed to Rome, the rising power in the Mediterranean, specifically to the Roman general Pompey, to come in and sort things out.
They asked Rome to intervene. That seems risky.
Hindsight is 20/20, I suppose. Pompey did intervene, all right, in 63 BCE. He marches into Jerusalem, settles the dispute, but then does something deeply offensive. He walks right into the Holy of Holies in the temple, the most sacred spot where only the high priest could go once a year.
Oh, no, that would not have gone down.
Not at all. It was a massive desecration in Jewish eyes. Pompey imposes Roman authority, Roman law, and that's basically the end of Jewish independence for a long, long time.
So the Hasmonean period ends with Rome taking control. What else was happening during this time? You mentioned writings.
Yeah, this period sees a real flourishing of apocryphal and pseudepigraphal literature. Lots of different ideas swirling around about God, the future, angels, demons, the Messiah, people grappling with their identity under foreign pressure, even during their own flawed self-rule.
And messianic expectations were heating up then.
Definitely. You see it in the writings. First, Maccabees talks about waiting for a true prophet. The Psalms of Solomon, likely written right after Pompey's conquest, cries out for a Davidic king to come and kick out the oppressors. The hope is really palpable.
Okay, and tensions between Jews and non-Jews were rising too.
Yes, that's another future. And critically, this is the era where we see the main Jewish religious groups that feature so heavily in the New Testament really emerge and solidify. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes.
Okay, so they come into focus during this Hasmonean roller coaster.
Seems that way. They represent different responses to the challenges of the time.
Right. So that leads us directly into the final historical period we need to cover before the New Testament opens.
The Roman period. Kicks off with Pompey in 63 BCE and lasts well beyond our time frame, up to 135 CE, really, after the later Jewish revolts.
And that offense, Pompey and the temple, that just lingered, didn't it?
Yeah, right. A constant source of resentment. But in many ways, Roman rule was a continuation of the Greek world they inherited. They built on the Hellenistic structures. Think of the Roman roads, Paul used them extensively, right? That infrastructure was largely built on Greek foundations.
Pax Romana.
Yeah.
The Roman peace, we hear about that. What was that actually like on the ground, especially in Judea?
Well, the Roman presence was everywhere. Government, laws, money, taxes, culture, their religion, the emperor cult we'll get to, and of course the army. The Pax Romana did bring stability across the empire, which was good for trade, for travel.
Right.
But for many Jews in Judea, it felt like an occupation. There was this constant undercurrent of resentment, this longing for freedom, for the redemption of Jerusalem, as Luke puts it when talking about Anna in the temple.
You mentioned two layers of oppression. How did that work?
Yeah. So first, you have the top layer, Roman imperial control. They might let local rulers function, like the Jewish High Council, the Sanhedrin, but Rome had the final say. The Sanhedrin couldn't execute someone without the Roman governor's approval, for example.
Right.
Second layer was the tax system. Rome farmed out tax collection. These tax collectors, like Zacchaeus, often Jewish themselves, would bid for the contract and then could basically add on whatever they thought they could get away with. Led to huge resentment, corruption, people feeling exploited by both Rome and their own countrymen.
Yeah, you can see why tax collectors were so unpopular. And then there's Herod. Herod the Great.
Herod, a major figure. Appointed king over Israel by the Roman Senate in 37 BCE. Ruled until his death in 4 BCE. Jesus was born towards the very end of his reign, probably around 5 BCE.
The Herod in the Christmas story.
That's the one. A complex figure, brutal, paranoid, but also an incredible builder. After he died, Rome divided his kingdom among his sons. Archelaus got Judea, Samaria, Idumea.
But he didn't last long.
No, he was so bad, Rome deposed him in 6 CE. Judea then came under direct Roman rule, governed by prefects or procurators like Pontius Pilate.
Oh, okay.
Then Philip got territories up north, and Herod Antipas got Galilee and Perea. That's the Herod Jesus mostly interacts with in the Gospels. Later, Agrippa, I get some of that territory, too. Matthew's Gospel mentions Joseph being wary of Archelaus when returning from Egypt, so they settled in Galilee instead under Antipas.
A complicated political map. So key developments in this Roman period.
Well, Herod's massive temple expansion project is huge, a wonder of the ancient world. The Pax Romana, despite tensions, did facilitate travel and the spread of ideas, ironically helping Christianity later, and the influence of Roman law, which shaped legal systems for centuries.
Okay, that gives us a solid historical timeline. Now let's dive into the religious climate, Judaism itself, and how it interacted with that Greco-Roman world.
Right. So after the return from exile, this question keeps bubbling up. Who is a true Jew? Especially with Hellenism pressing in from Alexander onwards. How do you stay faithful in this changing world?
Different groups had different answers, I imagine.
Exactly. By the first century CE, when Jesus arrives, we see these distinct groups offering different answers. The main ones we encounter in the Gospels are the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We also need to talk about the Essenes, even though they aren't named in the New Testament, and briefly, the Zealots.
Let's start with the Pharisees. They seem to be everywhere in the Gospels, often arguing with Jesus. Who were they?
The name Pharisee probably means separated ones, maybe self-chosen, maybe given by others, emphasizing purity. Their roots might go back to the Hasidim. the pious ones who resisted Antiochus Epiphanes, like we see in Maccabees.
Separated for holiness?
Kind of. Their core idea was that obeying the law meticulously was the key. Not just the written law, the Torah, but also the oral traditions that explain how to live it out daily. They believed faithfulness to the law would bring God's blessing and restoration. Think of Mattathias in Maccabees calling for zeal for the law. Strict Sabbath observance was a big part of it, too.
So really focused on practical righteousness through law-keeping. How influential were they?
According to Josephus, the historian, they were the most influential group among the ordinary people. Now, Josephus had links to them, so maybe a bit biased, but still, they had influence in Jerusalem, but also out in Galilee, somewhere on the Sanhedrin. They heavily influenced the scribes' teaching in the synagogues.
So the common people respected them?
Generally, yes, which makes their opposition to Jesus really significant. He was challenging figures the populace looked up to.
What were their key beliefs and practices then, beyond just being strict?
Well, they had this pragmatic side too, finding ways to apply the law practically. But yeah, known for piety. Fasting, tithing carefully, dietary laws, avoiding sinners to maintain purity. Their big project was developing the oral law, applying Torah to everything. Later written down in the Mishnah, many felt this earned God's favor.
And theology, what did they believe about, say, the afterlife?
Big difference here with the Sadducees. Pharisees believed in resurrection, angels, spirits, and afterlife with rewards and punishments. They also believed in both God's sovereignty, his plan, but also human responsibility and free will. They really shaped Judaism after the temple was destroyed.
Were they all identical, though? Or were there different strands within the Pharisees?
Good question. No, there were different schools. The two big ones were the school of Shammai, generally stricter, more conservative, perhaps more prominent before 70 CE, and the school of Hillel, often more lenient, more adaptable.
Hillel and Shammai. Heard those names.
Yeah. And Gamaliel was another major figure, a respected teacher in Jerusalem. Paul actually studied under him. They debated things, like divorce. Shammai had a very strict view based on Deuteronomy 24, only for serious misconduct. Hillel was broader, allowing it for things like, well, burning dinner, supposedly. Shows the range.
Okay, that paints a clearer picture of the Pharisees. What about the Sadducees? They often show up alongside them.
Right, the second major group in the Gospels. They were tightly connected to the temple and the priesthood. Mostly wealthy, aristocratic families in Jerusalem. Unlike the Pharisees, they didn't really survive as a movement after the temple fell in 70 CE.
And they didn't leave writings.
Not that we have. So we know them mainly from others, like Josephus in the New Testament. Their name might link back to Zadok, David's high priest, but that's not certain. Caiaphas, the high priest at Jesus' trial, was likely a Sadducee or very close to them. They were also powerful members of the Sanhedrin.
Okay, so connected to power in the temple, how did their beliefs differ from the Pharisees? That seems key.
Big time. First, they rejected the Pharisees' oral traditions. They stuck primarily to the written Torah, the first five books of Moses the Pentateuch. Possibly saw only that as truly authoritative scripture.
Only the first five books.
It seems that way, or at least gave them far greater weight. And because of that focus, they rejected beliefs not explicitly found there, like the resurrection of the dead. No afterlife, no rewards or punishments beyond this life.
Wow, that's a major difference.
Huge. They also emphasized human free will and responsibility based on teachings in the Torah itself, like choosing life or death in Deuteronomy. This contrasted with the Essenes, who were more deterministic. Remember Jesus debating them on resurrection? He quoted Exodus from the Pentateuch they valued to make his point. Clever.
Very clever. Okay, Pharisees and Sadducees, the main players in the Gospels. What about the Essenes? You said they aren't mentioned.
Correct. Not by name. They were a more withdrawn, ascetic group, lived in communities, some near the Dead Sea Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, is famously associated with them. Josephus says there were about 4,000 of them.
The Dead Sea Scrolls people.
Very likely, yes. The scrolls give us insight into their beliefs. They practiced communal living, shared property, cared for each other, a bit like the early church in Acts, maybe. But the Essene way seems more structured and required, whereas Acts describes voluntary sharing. Many Essenes were celibate. The group continued by adopting others or converts who went through initiation, including ritual washing or baptism.
Baptism, like John the Baptist?
Some scholars see parallels, yeah. Their theology was distinct, too. They were strong believers in predestination. God determined everything. They had this dualistic view of the world, a big struggle between forces of light, God, and darkness, led by a figure they called Belial, sort of a satanic figure. You see echoes of that kind of spiritual warfare language in Paul, too.
Interesting. And their relationship with the temple?
They generally stayed away from the Jerusalem temple. They considered the priesthood there corrupt, lived lives of intentional poverty, and they were incredibly strict about the Sabbath, even stricter than the Pharisees. Probably wouldn't even pull an animal out of a pit on the Sabbath, something Jesus implies other Jews would do.
So a very distinct, separate group. Did they survive the temple destruction?
Like the Sadducees, they mostly disappear from history after 70 CE. The chaos of the war likely scattered them.
Okay, one more group. The Zealots. More political.
More political, yeah. Though their motives were deeply religious. Josephus actually says their basic beliefs aligned with the Pharisees, but they added this fierce passion for liberty, believing God alone should be their ruler. Their hero was Phinehas from Numbers, who violently punished idolatry.
Phinehas.
Yeah.
Zeal for God's law.
Exactly. The Maccabees also looked to figures like Phinehas. Various zealot leaders popped up, aiming to throw off Roman rule by force. They became much more prominent in the years leading up to the war with Rome. They wanted to honor God through military resistance, believing God would fight with them.
And one of Jesus' disciples was called Simon the Zealot.
He was. It probably means he had belonged to, or at least sympathized with, the movement at some point, maybe before it became fully militarized and radical. Paul also uses the term zealot to describe his own former passion for Jewish traditions. So zeal itself wasn't necessarily negative, but the movement became increasingly violent.
So putting it all together, first century Judaism was diverse. A lot going on.
Absolutely not monolithic. You had these different groups, all Jewish, all trying to figure out how to live faithfully under Roman occupation in the Promised Land. Pharisees focused on internal renewal through law. Sadducees kind of worked within the system. Essenes withdrew for purity. Zealots wanted military liberation. And most ordinary people were probably just trying to survive, holding on to hope for a Messiah.
That's a really helpful summary. Now let's zoom out to the wider Greco-Roman world. What was the religious air they were breathing?
Overwhelmingly polytheistic. Believing in many gods was just normal, part of public life, private life, everything. The Greek gods, Zeus, Hera, Apollo, etc., had spread everywhere thanks to Alexander. The Romans adopted them, gave them Latin names, Jupiter, Juno. Apollo stayed Apollo, but it was the same basic idea. Plus, local gods were still worshipped everywhere, too.
You see that in the Book of Acts, don't you?
All the time. Think of Lystra, where the crowd thinks Barnabas is Zeus and Paul is Hermes. Or Paul in Athens, seeing idols everywhere, engaging with their altar to an unknown god. Mm. Or the huge riot in Ephesus, because Paul's preaching threatened the silversmiths making shrines for Artemis.
Right. Demetrius and the riot.
Yeah. Even on Malta, Paul gets bitten by a viper. They think the goddess Dyke Justice is punishing him, and when he doesn't die, they swing the other way and think he must be a god himself. It just shows how ingrained this polytheistic worldview was.
So how did that Greco-Roman religious mindset differ fundamentally from Jewish and later Christian belief?
Several key ways. Scholar Moyer Hubbard highlights these. First, it wasn't exclusive. Worshipping multiple gods was fine, even expected. No concept of needing to convert or abandon old gods for new ones.
Unlike, you shall have no other gods before me.
Exactly. Second, no real missionary drive. Third, the focus was usually practical. Appease the gods, get blessings, health, harvest, victory. It wasn't primarily about ethics or changing your lifestyle, though philosophy sometimes addressed that. Fourth, no central holy book like the Torah. Or later the Bible that held universal authority. No central place like the temple, though some shrines were hugely important. Fifth, worship was often more about performing the right rituals than personal faith, feelings, or character development.
Very different framework. What about the emperor cult? That sounds like a Roman thing.
It had Greek roots, honoring heroes, sometimes even living rulers like Alexander. But it really took off in Rome after Julius Caesar was assassinated in 44 BCE. The Senate declared him a god, Divus Julius.
So they made him a god after he died.
Yes. Then it started shifting towards living emperors. Around 29 BCE, cities in Asia Minor actually asked to build temples to Augustus, the current emperor, maybe partly to get in his good books after backing the wrong side in the civil wars.
Interesting. Did Augustus encourage it?
He was kind of cagey about it himself, but he allowed it, and the practice grew. In 13 BCE, Augustus took the title Pontifex Maximus, chief priest of Rome. All later emperors held that title. By the late first century, worshiping the emperor, or at least acknowledging his divine spirit or genius, was pretty much standard across the empire. It was tied up with loyalty to Rome.
Okay, so how did that impact early Christians?
Hugely. Because the core Christian confession was Jesus is Lord. In a world where Caesar was also demanding a form of lordship, often tied to divinity, saying Jesus is Lord, was inherently political. It was saying Caesar isn't the ultimate Lord. That's why it could be twisted into an accusation of treason, like in Acts 17, they're all acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, Jesus. Direct clash.
That makes the boldness of that confession really stand out. Okay, lastly, philosophy. Paul warns against it in Colossians. What role did it play?
Philosophy back then wasn't just abstract thought. It was deeply connected to religion and ethics, how to live a good life, the nature of reality. When Paul warns against philosophy in Colossians 2, he seems concerned about systems based on elemental spiritual forces of this world rather than Christ, potentially leading to weird practices or rules.
Not just Plato and Aristotle in a classroom.
Right. Though those schools were influential. The big ones were Platonism, Aristotelianism, Epicureanism focused on pleasure as the goal, but often misunderstood as just hedonism, cynicism rejecting conventions, stoicism emphasizing virtue, reason, duty, accepting fate that was hugely popular, and Pythagoreanism.
Stoicism sounds like it might have some overlap with Christian ethics.
Some surface similarities in ethics, maybe. But the underlying worldview pantheistic or materialistic for Stoics versus the personal creator God of Judaism and Christianity was fundamentally different. These philosophies were part of the intellectual air people breathed, interacting with both Jewish thought and the emerging Christian message.
Wow. Okay, this has been incredibly helpful. We've covered so much ground, the history, the different Jewish groups, the wider Greco-Roman context.
Yeah.
It really paints a vivid picture of the world Jesus stepped into.
It really does. And hopefully understanding this background makes the New Testament itself, you know, come alive in a new way. You see the tensions, the questions people were asking, the cultural assumptions. It adds so much depth.
Definitely. So for everyone listening, as you think about all this, consider how knowing this context, this diverse, sometimes conflicting religious and political scene, might change how you read the New Testament stories.
Yeah, how does it highlight the challenges Jesus and the first Christians faced? How does it maybe make their message, their success, even more remarkable?
And maybe think about which specific developments from this whole 400-year period seem most significant to you. Which ones really set the stage for what happens in the Gospels and Acts?
That's a great question to ponder. What had the biggest ripple effect?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We really hope this has given you some valuable insights and maybe sparked some curiosity to explore this fascinating history even further.